Today in Studio 360, for 35 years now, Weird Al Yankovic has been making parodies of America's most familiar pop songs.
Have some more yogurt, have some more Spam. It doesn't matter if it's fresh or canned, just eat it.
In the musical spoof business, nobody can touch him.
Everybody shut up.
But now, for the first time in his career, Weird Al has hit Billboard's number one with his new album, Mandatory Fun. I'll talk with Weird Al, and we'll get an exclusive performance from him. Plus,
what's the business, yeah?
A live set from Tune Yards, who's got one of the most original sensibilities in indie music right now. That and more is all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Don't take my life away, don't take my life away.
Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in 1983, before a lot of you were even born, Weird Al Yankovic released his debut album.
I hear those ice cream bells and I start to drool.
It included this parody of one of that year's biggest hits, Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll.
I know what I need, baby, I love rock and roll. So won't you go and buy half a gallon, baby? I love rock and roll. So have another triple scope with me.
There have been plenty of funny novelty records that have come and gone over the years, but Weird Al sold 500,000 copies of that album, stuck around, and his 1984 follow-up, In 3D, went platinum. That's the one with his Michael Jackson parody, Eat It. And now, three decades later, Yankovic's new album, Mandatory Fun, is number one on the charts. His first ever.
I never bother with baggies, glass jars, Tupperware containers, plastic cling wrap, really a no-brainer. I just like to keep all my flavors sealed in tight with aluminum foil.
Foil.
Never settle for less. That kind of wrap is just the best to keep your sandwich nice and fresh.
I spoke with him last summer when he was in the middle of making Mandatory Fun. Al Yankovic, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Great to be here.
So you have been around long enough to parody Billy Ray Cyrus and his daughter, Miley, Madonna and her daughter, Lady Gaga. Not only do you have multiple generations of fans, but the artists you parody have come to see your music as more than just some stunt. Lady Gaga called your parody of her song Born This Way a rite of passage. I want to play just a little bit of that song.
I'm so completely original. My new look is all the rage. I'll wrap my small intestines round my neck and set fire to myself on stage. I'll wear a porcupine on my head.
So at this point, not that you've been ever a vicious satirist, but how does it feel to be this kind of elder statesman, some kind of bizarro world version of Ed Sullivan and Dick Clark?
It's a very odd thing because, yeah, it's sort of a signal that an artist has reached a certain plateau in their career. You know, they've got the Grammys, they've got the platinum albums, then they get the Weird Al parody. So it's just part of the triumvirate there.
So you're a little younger than I am, but it's the 60s, it's the early 70s, and rock and roll is happening, and Hendrix is happening, and Dylan is happening. This guitar revolution of rock and roll takes itself very seriously in many ways. And you have an accordion and start writing parodies. How did that happen?
Well, oddly enough, my friends actually didn't want me in their rock bands with an accordion.
Really?
They weren't ahead of the curve. They didn't realize that the accordion would take over Western civilization the way that it obviously has.
There were no hipsters to rediscover it yet.
You know, I was the original hipster, I'm sorry to say, yes.
And at what point did you decide, well, the accordion is funny.
Well, I didn't intend it to be funny, but, you know, I love rock and roll, and I'd learn songs off the radio and play it, you know, on the accordion, and my friends would think there was humor in that. They thought the juxtaposition was ridiculous, and I didn't think quite so much, but I found that other people did, and I kind of used that to my advantage.
I started playing Doors songs on the trumpet. If I'd only understood what you understood. You jokingly say you're the original hipster, but the hipsters of right now are all embracing you. You've done on Cartoon Network, Robot Chicken, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, 30 Rock. Do you go to them and strategize of, oh, I want the cool kids to like me, or do they come to you?
You know, it's hard to proactively try to be cool or relevant. It just
it's the opposite.
You know,
of cool,
it kind of right? happens yeah. if it happens. So I don't know. You know, for a long stretch of my career, I wasn't considered cool. In fact, my manager will tell you stories about when I was starting out. He couldn't get his phone calls returned. He'd say, "Hi, I represent Weird Al Yankovic," and they'd say, "Oh, I'm so sorry."
Really?
So
even after you'd had hits?
You know, I had to have a lot of hits before I stopped being considered a one-hit wonder.
Then you were a two-hit wonder and a six-hit
right,
wonder?
Right, right. And then after all, oh, he's not going away, is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you won 3 Grammy Awards. Your first one in 1984 was for Eat It, named Best Comedy Record. And anybody who was alive then will remember the music video. It is a shot-for-shot parody of Michael Jackson's video for Beat It. The arrival of MTV just when you essentially, as you were starting out, is an incredibly fortuitous thing, right?
Yeah, I was sort of an outlier in that sense because, yeah, MTV and I started out at the same time. And when MTV started out, people were obsessed with it. I mean, you know, it was a 24-hour music video channel. People hadn't seen anything like that before. And, you know, I was certainly one of those people that would watch MTV for hours and hours every day. And that hit videos were things people were intimately familiar with. You knew every shot of those videos. So that made my job very easy because all you had to do was tweak things a little bit and people instantly knew what direction you were going.
Right. Well, let's go back in time to that moment and hear our special unplugged version of Eat It performed live right here.
Such a fussy young man. Don't want no Captain Crunch. Don't want no Raisin Bran. Well, don't you know that other kids are starving in Japan? So eat it, just eat it. Don't wanna argue, I don't wanna debate. Don't wanna hear about what kind of food you hate. You won't get no dessert till you clean off your plate, so eat it. Don't you tell me you're full, just eat it.
Eat it.
Eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken, have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried, just to eat it. Table manners are a crying shame. You're playing with your food, this ain't some kind of game. Now if you starve to death, you'll just have yourself to blame. So eat it, just eat it. You better listen, better do what you're told. You haven't even touched your tuna casserole. Chow down, or it's gonna get cold, so eat it. I don't care if you're full, just eat it.
Eat it.
Eat it.
Eat it.
If it's getting cold, reheat it. Have a big dinner, have a light snack. If you don't like it, you can't send it. Sure can, just to eat it.
Eat it.
That was Weird Al Yankovic and his band performing live the ultimate modern pop parody, Eat It. You sort of, in this unplugged way, you've sort of turned it into a Clapton-esque, Layla-like thing.
Yes, that was actually something that we had done for MTV in the late 90s. They wanted to do a parody spot based on the fact that I had kind of changed my look at that time, and their Unplugged series was obviously very popular. So we did this mock commercial for our new sound, and we did these Eric Clapton-esque versions of our hits.
I've always loved, and every time I've heard that song, I chuckle still at the phrase tuna casserole being in a rock and roll song.
And one of the first times, I believe.
I think. And can you introduce this greatest cover band on earth?
Yes. Over there on keys, Ruben Valtierra, Jim Kimo West on guitar, Steve Jay on bass, and John Bermuda Schwartz on drums.
As you're picking songs to do parodies of, do you have like a team of Weird Al interns who are just combing through all the different genres and say, this is a hit. This is about to become a hit.
Oh, you know, I do not. I don't have a whole office full of people saying, you know what you should do. No, I just personally go through the Billboard charts and go online, and I kind of make a master list of songs that I think are good candidates for parody. And then I try to think of every possible variation on a theme and see if there's anything that, you know, has some kind of spark where I can develop it into a full 3.5 minute long pop song.
Would you be willing to take suggestions from our listeners?
No.
Okay, good. Good.
I don't, because that's the bane of my existence. Every day of my life, people say, I got this great idea. I've been holding onto it since the third grade. It's like, oh, you should do this. So I tell people right off the bat, like, you know, I don't really take ideas from people.
What do you listen to at home or in your car?
A little bit of everything. I've got a 10-year-old daughter, so we mostly listen to what she wants to listen to in the car. But she's pretty
again warped. And again and again.
Yes, it's true. But I mean, thankfully, she's about as warped as me. And for about a 1 month period, we listened to "They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha" nonstop.
Really?
The car.
Clearly, you introduced that to her.
Oh
which
yes,
was yeah. The great novelty comic song of my childhood.
Yeah, that was in fact, I'm going to see Jerry Samuels, who's Napoleon the 14th, pretty soon. He runs a rest home now. So I'm going to.
Is that sad or not?
No, I mean, he's doing what he loves as well. I'm going to visit the people there pretty soon.
Really?
Yeah.
I understand, because I've never heard a recording of it, but you do a version of Elvis Costello's Radio Radio?
I do. You know, we do that. That's sort of our emergency song, meaning that if there's anything that happens on stage, the computer server goes down or something that makes it impossible for us to continue, we stop the show and say, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to go on with this. Radio, radio. And then we just go into that. So it's if you ever hear that in one of our live shows, it means something has gone horribly wrong.
Can we declare this a special emergency?
Let's do that. Here we go.
Light night dial, doing anything my radio advised. With every one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes. I was seriously thinking about hiding the receiver when the switch broke, 'cause it's old. The same things that I can hardly believe, they really think we're getting out of control. Radio is the sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. They say you better listen to the voice of reason, but they don't give you any choice, 'cause they think that it's treason. So you would better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio. I wanna bite the hand that feeds me. I wanna bite that hand so badly. Every evening, and they worry about the times ahead. But everybody else is overwhelmed by indifference and the promise of an early bed. You either shut up or get cut out. They don't want to hear about it. It's only inches on the reel to reel. And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. Radio is the sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. They say you better listen to the voice of reason, but
but they don't give you any choice, cause they think that it's treason. So you had better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio.
That's Weird Al playing, simply playing, not parodying, Elvis Costello's Radio Radio. Weird Al's new album, Mandatory Fun, is out right now, and it parodies everybody from Pharrell to Lord to Robin Thicke to that Australian girl who raps with a southern accent.
I got 99 problems, but a switch ain't one.
I'm so handy. Everyone said so. I'll crowd your bathroom. Resurface your patio.
Just ahead,
I'm confused. Are we still talking about yogurt here?
Tony Hale is up for his second Emmy for his role in the great HBO sitcom Veep. But before he was a big deal TV actor on Easy Street, he was just on a street.
My first theater show was Shakespeare in the Parking Lot, where we did Taming of the Shrew in a parking lot in the East Village.
I'll talk with Tony Hale next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Earlier this month, we started asking for entries for our latest listener challenge, the Battle of the High School Bards, we're calling it, and we're looking for poetry by high school students on the theme of summer. Before the school year begins, we're going to announce a winner. We've already received more than 100 entries from all over the country, poems about swimming, about summer camp, about staying out late. And one of our high school poets is on the phone with me now, Zofia, who is 16 and lives in Massachusetts. Hi, Zofia. This is Kurt Anderson. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, thank you.
Before we talk, would you read your poem for us?
Sure. I trip my way onto the screen porch, mercury at my feet and a tongue on my tooth, half woman, half calamity. It's 1 a.m., the sky is bleeding, and my forehead is leaking sweat. My hands are twisting around each other, searching for their mediator. I can't find you. It's 1 a.m. and I am turning over in my double bed. The fan's air is washing me. The broken clock watches me. And every sidewalk gap I've ever waded through plays behind my eyelids. I remember that summertime glows moist, that every white sheet is born from yellowing, wrinkled hands. 90 degrees can be frigid if palms and kneecaps and mouths, pink flush grapefruit mouths, are empty enough.
There are so many great phrases and images in the poem, like the sky is bleeding and grapefruit mouths and a phrase I just loved, half woman, half calamity. Do you collect those in advance and then when you have a poem you're writing, oh, I can use grapefruit mouths here? Is that how it works, or is your process such that you're writing the poem and they come up as you're composing?
I think it's definitely both. Like the sky is bleeding one kind of just popped into my head one day, and I was like, oh my God, I have to write that down and put that in something.
Uh-huh.
So that one was like pre-noted, but the other two you mentioned were just as I was writing, they just came up as I went along.
Yeah. Well, Half Woman, Half Calamity could also be the title of your memoir perhaps someday. Was there a particular poem that you read at some point in your earlier youth, that got you started writing poetry?
No, I don't think it was a particular poem. My mom writes poetry, and I just always thought it was a cool craft, and I started out writing really, really bad, like, stupid romantic poetry, but I think I've improved.
Yeah. Is this something you think, okay, this is a thing I've done in high school and I'll move on and become a biologist or a lawyer or something? Or do you think you're going to keep writing poetry?
No, I think I'm definitely going to keep writing poetry.
Excellent. Well, thanks for submitting your poem, and thanks for talking to me.
Thank you so much for giving me a call.
In the summertime, when the weather is hot, you can stretch right up and touch the sky. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go sailing in the sea.
So, high schoolers, there is still time to enter our Summer Poetry Challenge. The deadline's August 18th, and you can find out all the information at studio360.org.
Yeah, we're happy.
Tony Hale won an Emmy for his role as the sweet, pathetic, totally codependent aide to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's vice president on HBO's Veep. And now he's up for a second Emmy.
Remember, take care of Selena, okay? VP stands for Very Precious.
Tony Hale first came to our attention playing another adorable freak, the sweet, pathetic, totally codependent mama's boy, Buster Bluth, on Arrested Development.
I think we found a part of a pterodactyl under Fashion Island.
Wait, I think I see a pattern here. Tony Hale, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, and you do see a pattern. You're absolutely correct.
And given the pattern-ness, was there any reluctance to take the role on Veep?
No, because, I mean, I was a huge fan of Armando Iannucci, who created Veep, and then obviously Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who plays the vice president. And I kind of see Gary, the character on Veep, as kind of a high-functioning Buster. Buster
right.
Pretty much can't probably leave his room.
Yes.
He's probably just rocking in a corner. Whereas Gary, you know, he can handle society. And he actually steps up to the plate to defend his woman, whereas Buster does not defend his mother at all.
That's true. Now, Arrested Development was only on the air for 3 seasons and canceled in 2006. And ever since, its resurrection in some form or another was rumored. Did you finally make peace with the fact that, that's never going to happen, I'll move on?
Totally. I mean, when it finished in 2006, you kind of, I think with any kind of job you have, you kind of go through a mourning process when it's done and you kind of, you know, lay it to bed. And then the opportunity that, you know, when it just came to do it again, it was very, very surreal. And actually, I mean, honestly, I was cautious kind of doing it again because there was so much expectation put
yeah.
on it. And Buster is such an extreme character. But when I got on set, the first day I was on set, the whole cast was there. And when I heard everybody's character talking, and specifically Jessica Walter, who plays my mother on the show, her degrading, you know, patronizing way in her voice, it just clicked right back in. It was just like riding a bike again. It was very Pavlovian and terrifying at the same time.
You were trying to push me out of the nest. You were right.
Really?
Yes. I've grown, and I'm in love.
Hamster or turtle?
No, mother. Hamsters are gross. It's a female. Human. Female. Human. Whole thing. So, your parental responsibilities are complete.
What?
I no longer need you.
Well, you don't have to go that far.
I'm not a mother boy anymore. I'm a mother man.
And you slipped right in, even though it's 7 years later, as though time had not passed?
Yeah, and I didn't think, I thought it would take a little more work, but once I heard her voice, man, it just clicked right back in.
On Arrested Development, as they finally said, okay, we're going to do this new season, did you then go back and rewatch the first three, or did you just go with it and wait to be Pavlovianly commanded by the actress playing her mother?
I did. I kind of watched, because what's funny is I was watching the first season of Arrested, and I kind of skipped into episodes and up to the third, and Buster just got crazier and crazier. And so doing the fourth season, you know, I kind of wanted to, you know, just kind of ground him more, and just because the circumstances were so nuts, and just to kind of how would a person react to those circumstances, because Buster's had some pretty crazy circumstances, like his hand was bitten off by a seal. He's, you know, dating Liza Minnelli. You know, he goes to mother boy conventions with his mother. You know, it's some pretty nutty circumstances. So you could just kind of see how a person would just react to that.
If Arrested were to go on forever and ever, would Buster ever grow up, or would he just have to wait for her to die?
I hope not. I hope he never grows up. You really see kind of the depth of his depravity when there's some scenes where he begins to make a doll of his mother, a dummy, because she's not there. And you think, well, my God, it must be like months that he's been away from her. It's been 2 days, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he really cannot stand 5 minutes outside away from her.
Beyond the mama's boy part of him, one thing I love about the character is that he seems to me kind of a poster boy, emblematic of a what I think is this real and large-scale shift of the last couple of generations, which is adults who never managed to grow up. Is there some realness in him that you have drawn on from your life?
From my life.
Not from your life, but from the people you see. The people like him, not you.
Yeah. It's like, oh, good God, this is turning into therapy. Well, yeah, I mean, I think you do find situations where the parents, I mean, obviously Buster and Lucille are extreme cases, but where the kids are so smothered and they're so kind of helicopter parenting their whole life, and they just kind of live in this constant state of fear because their parents are giving them this fear of what's out there.
And now that you are a parent of a kid, have you taken that in that idea of non-helicopter parenting to heart?
Man, I mean, it's so easy to say, but it is hard to not be a helicopter parent. When I see someone, you know, in the past, if I've seen a child be mean to my daughter, it's just this rage that comes over you and you wanting to take over and, you know, stand up for her. And of course you do at times, but it's like they've got to walk through that. And that is tough.
Yes.
I mean, that is really, really, really tough. And you also, I mean, they're so innocent and so sweet. And the minute you see something harsh happen to them, you're just like, no, they're being poisoned, but like they have to walk through that.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of paying attention to the people you're responsible for, on Veep, you play the vice president's personal aide, her body man, attending to every possible need and whim.
Mm-hmm.
Veep has a level of realism, not documentary realism, but it seems like those characters are very realistically ambitious and egomaniacal and awful.
Yeah, I love that. Especially with politics, you do kind of hear these perfect sound bites. You kind of see people posturing for power. But the fact is they're human beings who are just like pressure cookers for massive decisions of our nation. And they have to freak out behind the scenes. They have to get insecure. They have to lose their minds. They have to vent. And I love that Veep kind of takes you behind the scenes and shows you that, shows the humanity. I mean, obviously, it's a satire. But it really kind of brings the humanity back to a little bit.
I want to play a clip from Veep so people know what we mean.
Are we early?
Yeah, I want to get there early. I want the people who are on time to think that they're late.
Oh, mind games. Love it.
Yeah.
I appreciate the reference to my potential suicide earlier. I'm not a joke.
No, you're the guy with the big bag of lip balm, Gary. You're f***ing Kissinger. Gosh.
Every single thing you say to me is emasculating. Do you realize that?
Yes.
That is Tony Hale from Veep.
Yeah. He's trying so hard to convince people, like, do you see what you're saying? And they're like,
yeah, we
see it. It's clear.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
okay,
exactly.
Well, as long as you got it.
You were not a kid when you got your breakthrough part in Arrested Development. You were 32. You'd been an actor for a decade or more. Had you gotten to the point where you worried, like, is this show business thing going to work out?
You know, it was one of those things where I was in New York for 8 years doing commercials. I did mainly commercials in New York for a long time and then theater. My first theater show was Shakespeare in the Parking Lot, where we did Taming of the Shrew in a parking lot in the East Village.
I can imagine being 32 and having had the career you've had and thinking like, geez, maybe my parents were right. Maybe I should have a fallback career.
Oh, yeah. But I think when you're in the business, I would say every single day you think that.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, I mean, should I be doing this? I mean, I knew I wanted to do it and just kind of keep walking with it because I enjoyed it. I was getting commercial work and then just kind of getting more accustomed to kind of like it's job to job. It's gig to gig.
As I was reading about you, I saw that you went to college in Alabama at this Christian college, Baptist college, and then to graduate school in Virginia at a Christian institution. Is traditional Christianity a big part of your life?
It is. I mean, it definitely is. It's there are people that I would like to take the microphone away from because it gives a bad rep for the other Christians. But I will say in my business, and I'm talking about uncertainty, to know that or to believe that someone has my back, really.
Right.
But I mean, I will say also with my faith, it's taught me a ton of lessons, actually. And one, I remember when I got when I booked Arrested Development, I remember going because, I mean, all I ever wanted was a sitcom, and that's all I ever wanted. And I remember when I booked it, I remember this place of going like, oh, this doesn't satisfy the way I thought it was going to satisfy. And I was really frustrated and slightly depressed. And it was just that kind of lesson, that life lesson. This really isn't just about faith, but it was just kind of, if you're not, and I feel like if you're not practicing contentment where you're at, you're not going to be content when you get what you want.
Yep.
And my whole time in New York, I just was constantly looking to that sitcom. And then it really, I wasn't being present. And it's ever since then, it's just been this, which I think is spiritual, just like owning where you're at and making the most of where you're at and waking yourself up each day to where you're at. Because it makes everything else just where you're living it rather than so far into the future. I literally just turned into Oprah.
That's all right. Well, I invited you to. And the fact that you, both Arrested Development and Veep, neither of them are in any way pious or reverent shows, and here you are a Christian. Does either of those things make it awkward for you in godless Hollywood?
No, not at all, because it's life, man. I mean, I think Christians that are, or really anybody for that matter, who are trying to put up a perfect image or how it's supposed to be, they're clearly not, acknowledging their own stuff and that everybody's got stuff. With both Arrested and Veep, I love that it shows just kind of how twisted people can be. But then you also see that, I think everybody acknowledges, wow, that's pretty twisted. Let's maybe try to go the opposite direction or, not follow this example and just use the comedy that way.
Tony Hale, it has been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Good.
Well, I feel just like a child.
I spoke with Tony Hale last summer. He's now up for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series at the Emmy Awards on August 25th.
Well, I feel just like a child. From my womb to my tomb, I guess I'll always be a child.
Still ahead this hour, if you can't cut it as a puppeteer, what do you do? Become a fantastic electro-afro-punk dance band and call yourself Toon Yards.
What's it gonna do if I'll never be a gangster?
Toon Yards perform next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. Ever since Meryl Garbus appeared calling herself Toon Yards, fans and critics have been going nuts over a style that blends African music with electro and dance and funk and sampling. Toon Yards' third album, Nicky Knack, has just been released. They joined us for a live edition of Studio 360 when their last record, Who Kill, came out.
If you move into his neighborhood, he'll never make a sound. If you move into his neighborhood, back my mail, I ain't never moved to my. hood, cause danger is crawling out the wood. But my boy never moved to my hood, cause danger is crawling out the wood.
That was Toon Yards performing Gangsta, and sitting with me now is the auteur, creator, lead singer, whole deal of Toon Yards, Meryl Garbus. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So in that song you sing, "What's a boy to do if he'll never be a gangster?" Who are you singing that about or to?
Let's see. Well, I wrote it in Oakland, California, and I was noticing the kids in the neighborhood where I was seemed to be forming a gang. And and they were kids who seemed to be sort of on the outside of things. And that was really interesting to me, this idea of how we need to have some kind of power or feel some kind of empowered feeling in our lives. And in order to get that, we try in different ways. And it was interesting to sort of see these kids... this thing that we all deem so negative or so bad, you know, gangs are bad and they're violent and whatever, but they were using this as a way to protect themselves and a way to empower themselves. And it was, yeah, that was my...
And as a way to perform a role, to play a part?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, yeah. And how we have to posture in a way in order to feel empowered in our lives, I think. And especially at a young age, yeah. You know, adolescence, when you've got sort of no ground to stand on. At least that was my experience.
Is it especially adolescent, especially male, especially American?
Well, I say that what's a girl to do if she'll never be a Rasta?
Right.
I mean,
right.
I was very influenced by reggae singing, and that, you know, it's the song is also, you know, this yearning for something that will never be, and then how can we be ourselves and be empowered and confident in ourselves, just how we are.
You, when you were even younger than you are now, spent time in Africa, in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen, and why?
College study abroad.
Really?
Yep.
So your parents made this happen, basically.
Oh, yeah. They made a lot happen. Thanks, Mom and Dad. they're out there.
But so you decided instead of Florence, you're going to go to Kenya? Right?
Yeah, yeah. My aunt and uncle they're both in medicine, and so they'd spent a year in Kenya when I was about 10, and it was hugely influential on me because I was in suburban Connecticut, and all of a sudden there was this world, you know, very, very far away that I could imagine and communicate with. But that's what it was. I studied Swahili language for a couple of years before I went, and then it was, I went to Smith College. So it was a 3.5 months of a program, and then a month and a half of feeling very, losing myself living and traveling in Kenya and Tanzania.
And how long after that experience did you say, well, there's some musical things going on here, and I'm going to put that into this new form that I'll invent.
With looping pedals and yes. Ukulele. Not for a while. That was a good 10 years ago that I was there, and there I had a whole, speaking of reinventing oneself, I had a whole career as a puppeteer in there somewhere. So it took me a while.
Really? Yep. How did that work out, that puppeteering?
Not so well for me, but no, it was actually great. I think a lot of what I do now is very similar. I mean, look what I'm wearing.
So now you're the... And for those who can't see, she is wearing paint on her face.
I've got these big...
multicolored crinoline shoulder pads.
Exactly, shoulder pads, which I can make talk. Hey, Meryl.
There you go. Wow, you are a puppeteer.
Yeah, yeah. I studied it. Yeah. So
now you're a puppeteer and your own puppet, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
For the last 20, 25 years, white American musicians, from Paul Simon to Vampire Weekend to you, have found things they love in African music and adopted it, and sometimes get flack for that. Were you given any pause about, should I do this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I still pause.
Yeah?
Let's all pause.
But what did you decide? It's all for the taken?
No, I don't. I mean, it is. I guess that's the truth of the matter. But I decided that I in this business of finding one's own voice and finding the truth of what my experience have brought me to, I have to make the music that I have to make. And all of these sounds really have resonated with me. I think a lot of what Western musicians find in African music, at least from my perspective, is different sounds, is these incredibly interesting sounds. And I think once you're captivated by those sounds, it's really hard to let them go. But it's really complicated. And I think, as I've talked about in other interviews and things, I think I will find what my... What's the word for it? I need to find my way of making that okay, whatever that is. I need to find, collaborations with African musicians or what we're doing here, discussing Western musicians taking African music and using it in their own. So, yeah. So it's still complicated.
How did you get from there to here, there being Smith College graduate puppeteer, to being this somebody in front of the scenes making music? I mean, that's not a necessarily natural progression.
No, I don't know. You were talking about reinventing, and I was like, I don't even know what happened. I know I had a puppet show, and all of a sudden, and then I had a ukulele, and then...
And speaking of ukuleles, which you have, I started noticing about 2 years ago when various The Cool indie crowd musicians would come on this show, and time after time after time, ukulele.
Yeah. Well, did you roll your eyes?
No, I just wondered... If somebody issued a memo or something at some time.
I don't know. I mean,
I like ukuleles.
Well, good.
My mother played the ukulele.
Oh,
yes.
So did my mother. I think it goes through... I think it goes through these resurgences. And to really answer your question, my mom bought me this... Well, she bought a ukulele at an Army-Navy store. I ended up with it. I was very depressed at about the age of 26, and I just started to write very sad songs on a ukulele, and that it just gave me such comfort to play this very simple instrument. And somehow that rolled into having a rock band with other guys in Montreal using a ukulele, and that
Canada.
Also... Canada.
Wow.
Yeah, it's in there.
It's all coming clear now.
Good for you, perhaps.
Well, we have time for many more songs from you, and one right now, if you wouldn't mind playing. Business?
Mm-hmm.
What's it about?
Business.
The audience knows. Perhaps the listeners don't.
There is a little bit of grappling with my new status of being able to be in the music business mixed with general angst in my personal and social life and the earthquake in Haiti. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Let's bring back your bandmates who are Nate Brenner, Matthew Nelson, and Casey Knutson, and hear Toon Yards. That's Toon Yards performing Business You can watch some videos of that performance at studio360.org. Tune Yard's new album, Nicky Knack, is out right now. And I'm afraid that's all for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening.
What's the business, yeah?
But high school poets, don't forget to send us your poems on the theme of summer. The deadline's August 18th at midnight. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisfirm,
Alana Harper,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Panamaneni,
Ariel Roland Wang,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Don't take my life away, don't take my life away.
PRI, Public Radio International.
40 years ago, a young British illustrator got the offer of a lifetime.
How'd you like to go to Kentucky and meet an ex-Hells Angel who just shaved his head?
Ralph Steadman talks about his years with Hunter S. Thompson.
You don't cover a story, you become the story.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Too fast to live, too young to die.